and stowed them away, they took up the oars and started to row. The tide, at least, was with them. But it quickly became evident that what they had taken to be their salvation was about to be their ruin. Instead of the entrance to a harbor, they were steering for a wave-pummeled beach. Coppin cried out, "Lord, be merciful unto us, for my eyes never saw this place before." Just when all seemed lost, the sailor at the steering oar exhorted them to use their oars to round the boat up to windward, and with the waves bursting against the shallop's side, they attempted to row their way out of danger. "So he bid them be of good cheer," Bradford wrote, "and row lustily, for there was a fair sound before them, and he doubted not but they should find one place or other where they might ride in safety." The shallop had nearly run into a shallow cove at the end of a thin, sandy peninsula called the Gurnet. The Gurnet terminates with a jog to the southwest known as Saquish Head. It was the beach between the Gurnet and Saquish Head that had almost claimed the Pilgrims. Once they rowed the shallop around the tip of Saquish, they found themselves in the lee of what they later discovered was an island. In the deepening darkness of the windy night, they discussed what they should do next. Some insisted that they remain aboard the shallop in case of Indian attack. But most of them were more fearful of freezing to death, so they went ashore and built a large fire. When at midnight the wind shifted to the northwest and the temperature dropped till it froze hard, all were glad that they had decided to come ashore. The next day, a Saturday, proved to be a fair, sunshining day. They now realized that they were on a heavily wooded island and, for the time being, safe from Indian attack. John Clark, one of the Mayflower's pilots, had been the first to set foot on the island, and from that day forward it was known as Clark's Island. They were on the western edge of a large, wonderfully sheltered bay that might prove to be exactly the anchorage they needed. Even though they had so many motives for haste, they decided to spend the day on the island, where they might dry their stuff, fix their pieces, and rest themselves. The shallop needed a mast, and they undoubtedly cut down as straight and sturdy a tree as they could find and fashioned it into a new spar. The following day was a Sunday, and as Bradford recorded, "On the Sabbath day, we rested." They spent Monday exploring what was to become their new home. They sounded the harbor and found it suitable for ships the size of the Mayflower. They ventured on land, but nowhere in either of Plymouth Plantation or Mort's Relation, the book Bradford and Winslow wrote after their first year in America, is there any mention of a pilgrim stepping on a rock. Like Cape Cod to the southeast, the shore of Plymouth Bay is nondescript and sandy. But at the foot of a high hill, just to the north of a brook, was a rock that must have been impossible to miss. More than twice as big as the mangled chunk of stone that is revered today as Plymouth Rock, this 200-ton granite boulder loomed above the low shoreline like a recumbent elephant. But did the pilgrims use it as a landing place? At half tide and above, a small boat could have sailed right up alongside the rock. For these explorers, who were suffering from chills and coughs after several weeks of wading up and down the frigid flats of Cape Cod, the ease of access offered by the rock must have been difficult to resist. But if they did use it as their first stepping stone onto the banks of Plymouth Harbor, Bradford never made note of the historic event. That would be left to subsequent generations of myth-makers. They marched across the shores of Plymouth, and found divers cornfields and little running brooks, a place, as they supposed, fit for situation. Best of all, despite the signs of cultivation, they found no evidence of any recent Indian settlements. The next day they boarded the shallop and sailed for the Mayflower with the good news. It had been a long month of exploration. Later, when looking back on their trek across the wastes of Cape Cod, Bradford could not help but see their wintry walkabout in biblical terms. New World Israelites, they had, with God's help, finally found their Canaan. But back then, in the late afternoon of Tuesday, December 12th, as the shallop approached the Mayflower, Bradford and his compatriots had little reason to believe they had found the Promised Land. Plymouth Harbor was commodious, but much of it was so shallow that a ship the size of the Mayflower which drew 12 feet, must anchor more than a mile from shore. The harbor was also without a navigable river to provide access to the country's interior. It was true that there were no native settlements nearby, but that didn't mean they would be immune to attack. The Indians in the region had already surprised them once. It would probably happen again. Worst of all, they were approaching what Bradford called the heart of winter, and many of them were sick. Indeed, some were on the verge of death. And then, that evening, Bradford received what would have been, for many men, the final blow. He learned that 5 days before, Dorothy May Bradford, his wife of 7 years, and the mother of his 3-year-old son, John, had slipped over the side of the Mayflower and drowned. Bradford never wrote about the circumstances of his wife's death. Much later in the century, the Puritan historian Cotton Mather recorded that Dorothy Bradford had accidentally fallen overboard and was drowned in the harbor. That she fell from a moored ship has caused some to wonder whether she committed suicide. Dorothy certainly had ample reason to despair. She had not seen her son in more than 4 months. Her husband had left the day before on his 3rd dangerous trip away from her in as many weeks. On the same day the shallop had departed, 7-year-old Jasper Moore, one of the 4 children placed on the Mayflower by their cuckolded father, died in the care of the Brewster family. 2 other Moore children would die in the months ahead. For Dorothy, whose own young son was on the other side of the Atlantic, the plight of these and the other children may have been especially difficult to witness. We think of the Pilgrims as resilient adventurers upheld by unwavering religious faith. But they were also human beings in the midst of what was and continues to be one of the most difficult emotional challenges a person can face, immigration and exile. Less than a year later, another group of English settlers arrived at Provincetown Harbor and were so overwhelmed by this naked and barren place that they convinced themselves that the Pilgrims must all be dead. In fear of being forsaken by the ship's captain, the panicked settlers began to strip the sails from the yards, lest the ship should get away and leave them. If Dorothy experienced just a portion of the terror and sense of abandonment that gripped these settlers, she may have felt that suicide was her only choice. Even if his wife's death had been unintentional, Bradford believed that God controlled what happened on earth. As a consequence, every occurrence meant something. John Howland had been rescued in the midst of a gale at sea, but Dorothy, his dearest consort, had drowned in the placid waters of Provincetown Harbor. The only clue Bradford left us about his own feelings is in a poem he wrote toward the end of his life. "Faint not, poor soul, in God still trust. Fear not the things thou suffer must. For whom he loves he doth chastise, and then all tears wipes from their eyes." Chapter 5. The Heart of Winter. The Mayflower left Provincetown Harbor on Friday, December 15th. Headwinds from the northwest prevented the ship from entering Plymouth Harbor until the following day. Both Plymouth Harbor and Duxbury Bay to the north are contained within 2 interlocking sickles of sand. The Gurnet, an extension of Duxbury Beach, to the north and Long Beach to the south. The Mayflower anchored just within Goose Point at the end of Long Beach, 1.5 miles from Plymouth Rock. Not until Wednesday, December 20th, after 3 more days of exploration, did they decide where to begin building a permanent settlement. Some voted for Clark's Island, their refuge during the shallop's first night in the harbor, as the safest spot in case of Indian attack. Others thought a river almost directly across from the island was more suitable. Unfortunately, Jones River, which they named for the Mayflower's master, was not deep enough to handle a vessel of more than 30 tons. The Mayflower was 180 tons. And the settlement site, the current location of Kingston, would have been difficult to defend against the Indians that left the area near the rock. The future site of Plymouth Plantation had much to recommend it. Rising up from shore was a 165-foot hill that provided a spectacular view of the surrounding coastline. On a clear day, it was even possible to see the tip of Cape Cod, almost 30 miles away. A stout, cannon-equipped fort on this hill would provide all the security they could ever hope for. The presence of the rock as a landing place was yet another plus. Even more important was the very sweet brook that flowed beside it, carving out a channel that allowed small vessels to sail not only to the rock, but up what they called Town Brook. Just inside the brook's entrance was a wide salt marsh where Bradford wrote, "We may harbor our shallops and boats exceedingly well." There were also several freshwater springs along the high banks of the brook that bubbled with as good water as can be drunk, an increasingly important consideration now that they were forced to ration what remained of the beer. The biggest advantage of the area was that it had already been cleared by the Indians, and yet nowhere could they find evidence of any recent native settlements. The pilgrims saw the eerie vacancy of this place as a miraculous gift from God. But if a miracle had indeed occurred at Plymouth, it had taken the form of a Holocaust almost beyond human imagining. Just 3 years before, even as the pilgrims had begun preparations to settle in America, there had been between 1,000 and 2,000 people living along these shores. As a map drawn by Samuel Champlain in 1605 shows, the banks of the harbor had been dotted with wigwams, each with a curling plume of wood smoke rising from the hole in its roof, and with fields of corn, beans, and squash growing nearby. Dugout canoes made from hollowed-out pine trees plied the waters, which in summer were choked with bluefish and striped bass. The lobsters were so numerous that the Indians plucked them from the shallows of the harbor. The mudflats were so thick with buried clams that it was impossible to walk across the shore without being drenched by squirting bivalves. Then, from 1616 to 1619, disease brought this centuries-old community to an end. No witnesses recorded what happened along the shores of Plymouth, but in the following decade, the epidemics returned, and Roger Williams told how entire villages became emptied of people. "I have seen a poor house left alone in the wild woods," Williams wrote, "all being fled, the living not able to bury the dead. So terrible is the apprehension of an infectious disease that not only persons, but the houses and the whole town take flight." No native dwellings remained in Plymouth in the winter of 1620, but gruesome evidence of the epidemic was scattered all around the area. "Their skulls and bones were found in many places lying still above the ground," Bradford wrote, "a very sad spectacle to behold." It was here, on the bone-whitened hills of Plymouth, that the pilgrims hoped to begin a new life. They decided to build their houses on what is called today Cole's Hill, overlooking the salt marsh. Situated between the shore and the much higher hill, soon to be known as Fort Hill, Cole's Hill was flat enough to accommodate a small settlement and was easily accessible from the brook. That night, 20 people remained on shore. They planned to begin building houses the next morning. But Thursday, December 21st, proved so stormy that the Mayflower was forced to set an additional anchor. The people on shore were without food, so despite the gale-force winds, the shallop set out from the Mayflower with much ado with provisions. The terrible weather persisted throughout the following day, making it impossible to begin work on the houses. In the meantime, the wind-lashed Mayflower had become a grim hospital ship. In addition to colds, coughs, and fevers, scurvy tormented the passengers. James Chilton had died even before the Mayflower arrived in Plymouth Harbor. That Thursday, Richard Britteridge passed away, followed 2 days later by Christopher Martin's stepson, Solomon Prower. On Friday morning, Mary Ollerton gave birth to a stillborn son. Not until Saturday, December 23rd, were they able to transport a work party from the Mayflower to shore. With their axes and saws, they felled trees and carried the timber to the building site. The fact that Monday, December 25th, was Christmas Day meant little to the pilgrims, who believed that religious celebrations of this sort were a profanation of the true word of Christ. Of more importance to them, December 25th was the day they erected the frame of their first house. No man rested that day, Bradford wrote. But toward sunset, the familiar cries of Indians erupted in the surrounding forest. The pilgrims took up their muskets and stared tensely into the deepening darkness as the cries echoed briefly and died away. Ahead of them was a wilderness that they could not help but inhabit with all their fears. Behind them was the harbor and the distant Mayflower, lights beginning to twinkle through her cabin windows, a smudge of smoke rising up from the galley stove in the forecastle. What would have astounded a modern sensibility transported back to that Christmas day in 1620 was the absolute quiet of the scene. Save for the gurgling of town brook, the lap of waves against the shore, and the wind in the bare winter branches, everything was silent as they listened and waited. The pilgrims' intensely felt spiritual lives did not prevent them from believing in witches and warlocks and living with the constant fear that Satan and his minions were out there conspiring against them. It was a fear that must have been difficult to contain as they stared into the deepening gloom of the American wilderness. After waiting a few more tense minutes, they decided to send the shallop back to the Mayflower, leaving the usual number of 20 ashore. That night, they were drenched by yet another rainstorm. It took them 2 more weeks to complete the first building, a 20-foot square common house. It didn't have a proper foundation. There just wasn't the manpower or the time for such a luxury. Known as an earth-fast house, the pilgrims' first structure probably possessed walls of hewn tree trunks interwoven with branches and twigs that were cemented together with clay. This wattle and daub construction was typical of farmers' cottages in rural England, as was the building's thatched roof, which was made of cattails and reeds from the nearby marsh. The house's tiny, barely translucent windows were made of linseed-coated parchment. The chimney, if in fact the house did have a chimney instead of a simple hole in the roof, was a primitive ductwork made of 4 soot-blackened boards that funneled the smoke from an open fire on the dirt floor. It was a most dark and smoky space, but for the first time, the pilgrims had a real roof over their heads. On the morning of Thursday, December 28th, they turned their attention to the high hill, where they began to construct a wooden platform on which to mount the various cannons they had brought with them aboard the Mayflower. This was also the day they started to plan the organization of the settlement. But first they needed to decide how many houses to build. It was determined that all single men that had no wives to join them should find a family to live with, which brought the total number of houses down to 19. From the beginning, it was decided that every man should build his own house, thinking by that course men would make more haste than working in common. Miles Standish appears to have had a hand in determining the layout of the town. At lectures on military engineering at the University of Leiden, soldiers could learn from the Dutch Army's chief engineer that the most easily defended settlement pattern consisted of a street with parallel alleys and a cross street. The pilgrims created a similar design that included 2 rows of houses for safety. For the present, Plymouth was without a church and town green, the features that came to typify a New England town. In the weeks ahead, the death toll required them to revise radically their initial plans. Instead of 19, only 7 houses were built the first year, plus another 4 buildings for common use, including a small fort-like structure called a rendezvous. The houses were built along a street that ran from Fort Hill down to the sea. Known today as Leiden Street, it was crossed by a highway running from north to south down to Town Brook. Around this intersection, the town of Plymouth slowly came into being, even as death reduced the newcomers to half their original number. Thursday, January 11th, was a fair day. Given the uncertainty of the weather, they knew they must make as much progress as possible on the houses, especially since it was still assumed the Mayflower would soon be returning to England. The frantic pace of the last 2 months was beginning to tell on